sometimes people who are deconstructing or reconstructing or reorganizing their faith. We bring various voices and conversations to open paths for discussion and conversation for those who wander in order to connect with Jesus on our journey. If you're watching live on Facebook or YouTube, feel free to drop a question or a comment in the chat boxes and we'll try to keep an eye out for them. It's great to have you here with us today. And today we have the pleasure of Dr. Janelle Curry. Dr. Curry earned a bachelor's from Bethel University in St. Paul and a master's and PhD in geography from the University of Minnesota. She served as a faculty member at Central College and Kelvin University in geography and environmental studies, and a dean for research and scholarship at Kelvin as well. Then she was provost for 7 years at Gordon College and interim vice president for academic affairs at Madai College in Buffalo. Now she's the president of the American Scientific Affiliation. So glad you could join us today.
Thank you. Dr. Curry, glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit about your religious background and your spiritual journey, just so we know who you are.
Yeah, I grew up in a Christian home. My father was a Baptist minister. My parents had planned to go overseas for missions, but they ended up instead staying in the United States. So it was in a small town in Illinois that I mainly grew up. And the context was, it was a pretty unchurched town. So there was a lot of ecumenical fellowship across the town rather than divisions. So it was pretty rich environment that way, and it was at a time of the charismatic renewal as well. And so I was very embedded in the church, of course. And I was also somebody who was always asking questions. And so I actually left home a year early to go to college. And probably it was that yearning for answers that led to that. And the first college I went to was not able to answer the kinds of questions I had about how I would live my faith out in society. But then when I went to Bethel University, I felt like I was introduced to this whole rich Christian intellectual tradition. And that's what really made the difference in my life. And since then, it's just been, you know, mining that rich tradition, whether it's Catholic tradition, Anabaptist, Reformed, and using those resources to help me navigate my life. So that's a little bit of my journey.
All right. Well, you know, tell us a little bit more about your educational background and your interest in science.
I think even though my family was not particularly science oriented, they weren't afraid of science, I guess. But I would say what really was instrumental in my life is I always liked land. And I remember when I was 5, we actually lived in North Carolina, and my fascination with the red clay soil, and to this day, I can still sort of smell it. And then growing up in Illinois, it was a strip mine area, and just being, feeling the pain of the land as the strip mining was taken away the topsoil, and then never would the land be the same. So always this sense of paying attention to the land and being interested in farming. I spent a lot of time on a farm growing up because I had a horse. And so it's those things that led me to always be interested in the environment and the land and the health of the land around me. And as an undergraduate, I was actually a political science major, always wanting to take more science, but never able to do it. So then finally, in graduate school, going into geography, I really found a home because I could do both the natural sciences and the social sciences together. So that's why I ended up with a PhD and a master's degree in geography.
I just wanted to chime in and say that we are live on both YouTube and Facebook. And if you'd like to ask a question of Dr. Janelle Curry, please chime in and we'll try and get you in. Everything's up and going. So sorry to interrupt you, Christine. Go ahead.
Oh, no, that's okay. Yeah. So I think of some of the geography classes that I had in school, and a lot of it was memorizing where things were, were located, like mountains and capitals and rivers, plateaus. But then it seemed like as I went more advanced in high school, then I took a human geography class in college, that there was a lot more interaction and connection in, you know, why did this people group migrate west, or why did this happen? And I found that very interesting. And in fact, I, even when I had my first interview for a job at Northwest Airlines, and one of the things we were talking about were these airports and all the maps that I had been looking at in my geography class, and I could talk about maps, and that's one of the skills that they were really looking for. So, what were some of your favorite things about the geography programs and classes that you were learning, and how does that relate to land, and how does that now relate to your leadership role as the ASA president?
I would say that always I was drawn to the generic sort of description of geography is it's about interpreting ordinary landscapes and answering that question, why does this look the way it does? And then of course you go into the normative of then what does this mean? How should we shape the landscape? So I just absorbed it all, everything from economic geography to soil science to climatology, all of those things, because it was helping me make sense of what I saw around me. So I ended up doing quite a bit of research on human land interactions and environmental policy. And so that was really became my expertise, is around the interaction of those two. But then it led me into looking at religious worldviews and how religious worldviews or communities impacted the land. How did those frameworks, religious frameworks, impact how they farmed or how they constructed environmental policy? So in that sense, that's sort of the direction that it's taken me to ask the question about faith and science.
So you've held a number of pretty significant leadership roles as provost, as dean, even just being a university professor. And recently you were selected as the new president of the American Scientific Affiliation. So for those new to the program, what is the ASA? And then tell us a little bit about your responsibilities as the new president.
Yeah, the American Scientific Affiliation has been around for 82 years now, and it's a professional association of scientists, social and natural scientists, who are people of faith that come together to explore issues of faith and science. And also, it's an organization that tries to help them grow in their understanding of faith and science in their professional careers. And it really creates a space for people to come together, because often scientists, if they're in a secular environment, they can't talk about their faith. And when they're in a faith environment, often they don't have people to talk to about their science. So it becomes this space where people can come together and have that kind of rich interactions with each other. Some of the goals that I have within my responsibilities, I'm part of a leadership team, and the areas that fall specifically under me are really around the scholarship. The ASA is a scholarly professional society, so we publish articles and have professional meetings. So that's part of my responsibility. And also, I am really focused on how do we provide opportunities for our members to grow in their faith, grow in their professions, and grow in their understanding of their faith in relationship to science.
But you also have the next winter symposium, which is January 28th, is on scientists and their involvement in church and serving the church. So this isn't just for scientists. There's an outreach to the church community too. Tell us about the symposium. What is it? When is it? And how can people tune into it?
Yeah. COVID really brought this about in that when COVID came and our annual meeting had to go online and all these other things, it became a real opportunity for us. So one of the things that we did is create this winter symposium, which is a webinar so that people can join around the world. And it's just one afternoon and we invite a major speaker, and it's a speaker that speaks to the broader community. So it's really meant to create an environment for people to talk about scientific topics within the broader church. And so this year we have Walter Kim, who's the president of the National Association of Evangelicals, and then Jessica Mormon for a respondent. And the topic is about scientists in the church, the challenges of scientists in the church, and scientists serving the church. So it sort of bridges the desire of ASA to help us think about what it means to be a scientist in the church and how can we better serve, and how can churches better understand scientists as well. If you're interested in the symposium, you can go online to the ASA website, which is www.asa3.org, and go to the events calendar, and registration will be open January 1st, but it's free, and we're encouraging people to gather together to have the conversation with us.
And like a good Christian, we probably should have a potluck along those lines.
Exactly.
Too, right?
Exactly. Food always comes with good conversation.
So you have done some research specifically on women in leadership. So I'd like to hear about your research. Did you see differences between secular and Christian organizations? And what kind of findings did you discover in your collection of data and analysis?
Yeah. My co-partner in a big research project was Amy Reynolds from Wheaton College, a sociologist. And we decided to look at the evangelical nonprofit sector. And our goal was to find out which groups were doing the best in advancing women in leadership, because we wanted to know what instructions we could give to people rather than talking about problems, talk about what are the solutions. And so we started with 1,400 organizations that we looked at 990 data to see what their levels of women in leadership were. And then we went to surveys of these organizations. And then we picked the top organizations and interviewed the top leaders in that organization, men and women, to find out what went right. And it was greatly encouraging, just because there are some patterns. And I actually think the patterns are probably ones that are transferable between secular and religious organizations. Like the need for leaders at the top to actually state what their position is on women in leadership so that it's verbal and people know. And just the professionalization of the atmosphere of the organization. I think a story that I heard long, long ago was around when Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister of the UK. One of the things one of the men on her cabinet said was, it quit being a men's club. And that was a positive to him. So whenever you professionalize, you start to feel like everybody's welcome at the table, rather than having these kinds of informal networks. So those are a couple of the things that you would find, which I think, again, are applicable across organizations.
So what are some of the specific challenges that you have experienced being a Christian woman in a scientific community?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that, and I think I experienced the same kinds of challenges as any woman in the era of time I grew up in and worked. So if any of the listeners have watched the Nova show, Picture a Scientist, you know, it's just a great depiction of the challenges of women in the sciences, but in academia in general. And I think I've faced a lot of those challenges, whether it's trying to get a voice or at the first college I was at, there were lots of challenges around maternity leave. They had no maternity leave, but a lot of that was across the whole country as women came into professional positions. So I don't know how much what I experienced in the secular environment had to do with me being a person of faith. It seems to be it was more about being a woman at a time when things were so changing in society.
Well, how about then in the church? What experiences as a leader or a woman in a science have you experienced in the church? Is women a more dominant issue, or is the scientist piece a more significant factor?
I think it makes it doubly difficult in terms of people interpreting who you are, you know, because of assuming that you're not a scientist and that women aren't scientists, and then assuming that as a woman you're not in a professional position, it often makes you feel like you don't have a voice or that people have trouble interpreting who you are. You know, one example of that is going to a meeting of scientists at University of Michigan that was called by a local pastor, and I got an invitation to go to, and sitting there all day with all these scientists, and I was the only woman who was a scientist at the table, and the pastor just could not figure out who I was, because his wife was also there helping, serving and everything, and there were some graduate students that are women. It's like you just don't fit. And so I felt over the course of that day, I felt like I wasn't being listened to. And it took me a while to figure out what was going on. It might have even been on the way home because I hadn't experienced that in a while. But being back in a setting that had been organized by a pastor created that environment. In some ways, the other scientists, they understood who I was, but it was harder for the pastor to figure out who I was because I was a Christian, and so I shouldn't be a woman that was there as a scientist.
Yeah, I've definitely had similar experiences across my life.
And have you experienced it where it takes you a while to figure out, why am I feeling like I'm not making any progress in this conversation?
Yeah, sometimes. I guess it's happened enough now that it's like, oh, I know what this is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I've got a general question for the both of you. And we're talking about two different worlds here, the scientific community, maybe academia, and also the Christian church, maybe more narrowed, the evangelical church in the West. And my question to you is, the indifference, or maybe that feeling that you're invisible in both of these rooms, do they parallel each other? Are they kind of equal? Is it more in one area than the other?
that you feel invisible?
I think being a scientist, historically, I've been thinking about this because, of course, I've had a long career. And what I experienced earlier in my career, it's really hard to discern what is the authority that I've gained over time. Sometimes you gain more authority by being older, and what is a change in the environment in terms of the scientific community. On the other hand, within the evangelical church, I am not sure how much it's changed. I think that that's been more of a challenge, or within evangelical organizations, it still, I think, remains a real challenge.
Now, I want to piggyback on that a little bit here. We're talking to Dr. Janelle Curry, who is the president of ASA, American Scientific Affiliation. So I have had acquaintances tell me when Barack Obama was elected president, first African-American president, that really the race question has been settled. You know, actually somebody said to me, look, Barack Obama's president, Oprah's the wealthiest woman in the world, Michael Jordan is the most known athlete. Why are we still talking about systemic racism? Right. Now, there might be some watching right now who would say to you, doctor, you're the president of a Christian science organization, and we're still talking about this kind of idea, this patriarchal environment or climate, have you will. How do you respond to that kind of logic?
Well, I think if you use the Barack Obama example, I think clearly by him being president, and we have these people who break whatever stereotypes there are, it gives people within that community, and this is true of seeing women in leadership, gives them a model toward which they can aspire, right, and identify with. But as we've seen with having an African American as president, it did not solve the structural problems underneath, because we've continued to struggle with those. And, you know, in, since he's left the presidency, while he was the president, there's still structures that work against that inequality. And so it's not about individual intent, but about structures and the way we do things that we have to become more self-reflective on.
So basically what you're saying is the ASA, as far as evangelical groups go, is kind of an outlier here. They're kind of leading the way with integrating female leadership. I want to ask you directly, and maybe I should start with this foundational question. The climate that you've suggested, the climate certainly that is widely presented in the Nova documentary that you mentioned, picture of a scientist, of this second-class citizenship of women in that field and in the Christian community. I know that wasn't in the documentary, but I'm including it. Is that Western in nature, or do you find that to be globally universal? In both fields, science and the church.
I think it depends. It's clearly there's a cultural element to always issues of race or being a woman in a field, but it doesn't play itself out the same in different places, because there are countries where computer scientists and engineers are half women. And that's not true in the United States. So somehow the particular culture of a country or a region impacts how the gender dynamics are play out in a particular place when it comes to science. And that's true with religion too, because you have some countries where the whole history of women in leadership has never been an issue. And that's part of the culture of a place. So when Westerners or American evangelicals that have come in with a particular frame, they've run into barriers with trying to impose a gender role process because that did not resonate with the culture that's underneath it. So I see a lot of these things as cultural.
Just chiming in quickly, and then I'll let Christine follow up with a comment from YouTube. Dr. Clark Van Gilder writes, "It is inexcusable for anyone to doubt what Dr. Curry is saying, given how well it is now documented. For example, the less female your name is, you receive more grants, interviews, publications." So Dr. Van Gilder is seconding your statement.
The depth of it comes out in that Nova film where there's a woman psychologist who is showing students how you identify one kind of language or roles with women or one with men, and how she showed that even she had trouble with that. You know, it's just ingrained. It's so ingrained. It's so deep. It's so deep. So it's not women hold these, you know, it's just part of our culture. And so that attempt to be more self-reflective is about the only thing you can do, and to change the structures so that there are measures to remind you to be more open and inviting so that you don't fall into the old patterns.
So structures are really hard to change. And sometimes when changes are made with good intentions, they have unintended negative consequences also. So some of your research has been looking into what works and what makes things better. And I really love the idea that rather than just sitting around and complaining, we're looking for what makes things better. So tell us about, how do we do better? What are some strategies that are helpful?
Well, I could just talk about the ASA because, you know, I don't know that the ASA is any different than any other organization that then struggles with this, but we had a difficult time getting women on what was the executive council for many years because you had to be a fellow of the ASA, which is voted by the majority of the membership into being a fellow of the ASA before you could be considered for being on council. And so you had the problem of people, mainly the men, knowing each other, fewer women. So you couldn't move women up to the top very easily. And the men recognized that this was a challenge and tried different strategies. But more recently, the ASA decided to remove the requirement of having to be a fellow to be in leadership. At least only the majority have to be fellows on what was the executive council. Well, that immediately opened it up where you could start to look at how we could change the representation at the top. And it's changed the distribution of women at the top. So changing structures like that, what is getting in the way of people flourishing? And usually when you do that, it creates opportunities, not just for women, but for men too. It helps you better fulfill your mission in general when you remove those barriers.
So I can think of some examples where if you remove too many barriers, you now have people who potentially aren't qualified. So how do you have a balance there?
Oh, The goal should always be to have a balance of skills at the table. And that's what opens it up to other people. It's about who needs to be there. What skills do we need at the table in order to fulfill our mission? And organizations thrive when they have a variety of skills, not just one kind, but a variety of skills recognized in the leadership. So I don't think it is reducing qualifications. It's more looking at the wholeness of a person and everything they might bring and how that might lead to the flourishing of the organization.
I want to reserve my right to whinge and complain a little bit. I'll take that back from you, Christine. I'm all for hearing about solutions, but I want to dial back for a second on a couple of things you said, Doctor. One of them that you didn't feel that the climate is universal around the globe, and there's some data to back that up. I can kind of channel what maybe our atheist viewers or skeptics are watching right now, and they're saying maybe that this climate is more pervasive in both the church and academia in the West because we do come from a Christian culture, and that might be backward when it comes to how we view gender equality. What would you say to that?
Well, I would say that the challenge of both these kinds of institutions, academia and the church, is that academia tends to be a kind of an informal culture without a lot of structure. So getting through a doctorate degree, a PhD, really requires working with a group of faculty. There aren't clear ways to get through it, so it has a certain informal and often faculty culture. Feels like it's accountable to within, but not without. And in some ways, the church can be an informal culture like that too, especially the evangelical church that doesn't have a lot of structure to it. So I would probably push back and say the sociological structure of these institutions make them more prone to creating problems.
Well, for those who are new to the show, I am a Christian. I play an atheist for arguments online. So, but let me just come back to this and say, when we just went through the Me Too movement, we saw what happened in Hollywood, and reputations were not only ruined, but careers were ended. Some people even ended up in jail. And if we contrast that to what happened in the evangelical church, we see people defending indefensible behavior. We see people getting shuffled around, wrist slaps, and so forth. In essence, is the church a few steps behind our secular society when it comes to gender equality and the treatment of really... I could think, again, going back to the Nova special, if that group of PhDs from MIT, the female professors who came to the president and the provost, handed in that data, and they were told, John MacArthur-like, go home.
Yeah.
I can imagine the uproar that would have ensued. And yet Beth Moore, a female evangelical voice in Christianity, very prominent, very influential, a lot of followers. She's made a great impact for the kingdom of God, was told to go home. And she stayed in that environment for years before she finally left it. Can you comment on these two worlds and how is it shocking to you as a believer in Christ and somebody who believes that the Holy Spirit does infuse the Christian church? Why are we lagging in this area?
Well, it makes me angry. It makes me sad. You know, as a scientist, I look at it and I would say as somebody who has been in administration, again, I analyze it as, for some reason, evangelicals in particular, not alone, but in particular, build structures where there is very little accountability. And so instead, religious language is sometimes used as a trump card to close down things that ought to be part of accountability. All leaders must be accountable. And we have a problem in the evangelical community where people are unable to hold the leaders accountable. And some would say it's because it has created a culture of a personality. Mm-hmm. And so those personalities dominate, but there's no structure underneath that holds them accountable for their behavior. And then it allows them to be abusive by using a kind of religious trump card to stop any kind of accountability. I think the Mars Hill podcast of Christianity Today is just a classic example of that.
Yeah. So I see kind of a flip side of the accountability thing too. The sometimes it's called the Billy Graham rule, where the man in leadership is never permitted to be alone in a room with a woman. And you could never say carpool to an event together or go to lunch together. And one of the consequences or side effects of this is that the women get excluded. So, yep. So now you've tried to build this parameter to improve maybe accountability, but at the exclusion of women who now cannot be involved.
Well, and I would even say with some of that is the fear that the woman is somehow going to taint the man, right? Why is she seen as a seductress? Why can't we be colleagues and surely have professional standards in place? But what keeps us from being colleagues and being able to maintain healthy boundaries that are recognized as just being healthy people? We're professionals. And that's part of that professionalization, creating a culture of professionalization where you can be colleagues without worrying about that. But in some of the research I've done, you can see that there were some of those rules that people were struggling with maintaining those rules because they did have women in leadership and they did need to be able to work together in a different way.
I want to ask you maybe a difficult question. I might be backing you in the corner here as the leader of a group that welcomes all, all different denominations. But do you find that this environment is more profound in particular denominations or corners of theology? And I'll preface this by telling you just a short story about a friend of mine who converted to Catholicism based on this issue, that he found the evangelical church was hyper-patriarchal and didn't really give, women had to sit in the back of the bus. And he said, John, he said, the Catholic Church has a history of elevating women. They've been made saints. There's feast days for women. They show greater respect, even though we still don't allow them in the priesthood. I believe that the Catholic Church has a much more favorable position toward honoring the great input that women have had from the faith from the cross to modern times. So I just, I know you'll have to go gentle into this dark night, but
from the virgin birth, I think not just the cross.
Yeah, that's right. There are always trade-offs with every tradition. And I have a daughter who is Catholic, and I affirm her choice. But recently I read a book by Beth Allison Barr called The Making of Biblical Womanhood. And she's a medieval church scholar. One of the arguments she makes is that indeed before the Reformation, there were more roles for women, and that they could choose not to be married, and then they would have leadership roles. And one of the things the Reformation did is make sure that women had no place other than in a family. And within the Reformed tradition, in fact, congregations tend to count families rather than individuals. So I think there is much for the American evangelical community to think about in terms of where we began to focus so much on family that we minimized calls from God. So, you know, I'm sympathetic to somebody who chooses one tradition over another. It's always sort of a trade-off.
Mm-hmm. And that might depend on where you are, too. I mean,
that's right.
Like in my area,
your family's,
what's available in your area? What's the culture in your local community, too?
And you usually have relationships, and often it has to do with relationships that determine your decision at any one point in time.
Well, and sometimes it is because you're part of a family, right? You have to make a decision that works for, you know, what's the best option for the whole family, which might not be the best option for any particular individual. But we are connected relationally with others.
And I think often then there's this trade-off of, if it's good for everybody else, then I will be there. But because of not feeling understood completely as a woman and a scientist, that you end up withdrawing and maybe investing someplace else for your spiritual growth.
Yeah, I understand that. I feel like that sometimes, for sure. Yeah. You mentioned earlier, and I want to kind of go back to it, when we were talking about methods or ways of improving women in leadership or in involvement, vocalizing, when the leaders vocalize their view on women. Would you talk a little bit more about that? You mentioned something about men have asked you questions about how they can improve.
Oh, yeah. I think one of the most profound things is the leader in the organization just saying where they are, because some of our research showed that part of the discomfort was that men and women didn't know where the leadership was. So by the leadership just articulating it, then it just brought about clarity. Because women tend to be in this situation where they will have male colleagues who are going to churches that don't recognize women in leadership, and they're working in a nonprofit, Christian nonprofit, and so they're not knowing where their colleagues are. So the more people can just lay it on the table, the better it is. And then also, women tend to carry things with them that keep them from taking advantage of leadership opportunities. So the leaders need to just try to remove barriers from them to empower them to take it on. Probably, you know, one of the most profound conversations I had around the women in leadership study was with a man where we were talking about these findings. And he said, you know, I went to a workshop with my wife. At the workshop, the person at the head prayed for everybody to follow Jesus. And I just turned to my wife and I just said, I just wanted, and they had been married 40 years or plus. I just want you to know you can follow Jesus. And 2 days later, she came to him and said, you have changed my life.
Wow.
So he was like, I didn't know I had changed her life, right? It was because he gave her the freedom to let go of all those societal expectations. You can let those go. And it was incredibly freeing. So the importance of men telling women, please let go of those societal expectations and serve. You know, it's just very freeing, because women carry these expectations with them everywhere.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think of my own life. I was called. I have no doubt about it. God very, very clearly called me to study aerospace engineering. and to be a witness for him in the scientific community, both of those pieces, the scientific and engineering community, that includes me. And that was a very clear calling that occurred more than once in my life, confirmed. And yet I would have teachers or youth pastors, yeah, or church leaders tell me, well, maybe you don't want to go into engineering. Maybe you want to be a flight, yeah, attendant, a stewardess, or, you know, you really don't even need to go to college. Women should be moms and wives. That's really what the Bible says that you should do. There's, you know, you don't need to go on to school. I've been told that I'm a disappointment, or why would you go back to work after you have kids? And all of these never stop to look at what God called me to do. I am a wife. I do have kids. I can be a mom. I can be an engineer too. I guess we have to realize that we don't have infinite time. So really there's some pressure on women to try to do everything. And that's another challenge, but, we do need to follow what God calls us to do.
Yeah.
That's really important.
Yeah. And I think that is the message, is women need to follow their calling. And I've been, you know, really impacted by a book by Mary Stuart Van Leeuwen called Gender and Grace, where her husband's an Old Testament scholar. She's a psychologist, and she talks about the effects of the fall on gender relationships, and their interpretation is that it led to men aspiring to power and women's being enmeshed in relationships. And how, for my read of that then, is men have to be aware of their tendency to want to aspire to power, and women need to be challenged to not always put their relationships first. They have to listen to what God's calling them to do. And often this means for women that they go against societal expectations, or you get extended family comments. For example, when you travel for work and you leave the kids home with their father. Well, and you go, why shouldn't a father take care of their children the same as a mother? Mm-hmm. But the signals that you get from society are very different between men and women that way.
I think that's probably especially true in the church.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let me try and put you in a corner again. Skeptics of the church, atheists, agnostics, people of other faith, will look at it and they'll say, listen, the people who believe in a flat earth, are two-thirds of them are evangelical Christians. The people who are arguing for creationism over modern science and multiple fields are evangelical Christians. The people holding women back in positions of leadership and telling them to go home in public and getting the whole room to applaud, evangelical Christians. Why would anyone in their right mind be an evangelical Christian? And then on the other side, you have Christians pointing to secular historians like Tom Holland, who says, if not for Christianity, we wouldn't have gotten this far. If not for the words of Paul, that in the body of Christ, we don't see male or female. And so they will point to a source like that and say, there really isn't a problem. Now, here's my question for you. There is this defensive attitude in Christianity that anything the other side promotes or is for can't be right? We live in a dichotomous thinking world of black and white. We're wearing the white hats, they're wearing the black hats. The critics of the church can't possibly write, and we have our experts and even experts not in the church like Tom Holland saying everything's fine. Where do you land in that conversation? And what do you say if you're at a cocktail party with these two people talking to add your view?
Well, I think I always because of my education and being exposed to the full range of Christian traditions, I think I'm not sure I can identify with like a fundamentalist expression of Christianity. I don't identify with that. And certainly there are choices I have to make to be within Christian communities that aren't going to ignore me, but use my gifts is how I would feel. So I would just say to people, don't simplify something that is very complicated. Culture is complicated, and that may be American culture and not Christian faith. But then people who on the faith side have got to listen to people rather than become defensive. They need to ask questions about why you think that. You know, they need to look at evidence and make judgments on that. So that it's very complicated, and both sides need to understand the complications and ask questions to help them understand.
All right, I want to jump in here on that, because you made a statement about it's complicated, and I think that's such an aha thought that we need to hang on to. There's this apologetics conference that comes to my area every November. And I've been to it, and I'm familiar with most of the people who've spoken at it over the years. And I feel like so often they oversimplify. They have just little memes and little sound bites and little pat answers and little gotcha questions and answers. And so often they're not accurate, and their science is just terrible. You know, they make these, you know, statements about that just, they don't reflect what we know about the world around us. And this is being used to prop up Christianity as, you know, here we're providing you with these apologetics, these reasons to believe in Christianity, but they don't hold water. So what do you see is this a problem with modern apologetics, and what do you recommend?
Well, and I think it's a problem with modern society too, in that we have sound bites and then there's the lack of substance underneath. And the problem I have with that kind of apologetics is, well, I'll give an experience on the science side. Is I taught a 4-week seminar for grade school teachers in teaching science, and they wanted simple things to do with their kids. But the problem is those things that they wanted to do to represent some scientific principle did not actually represent the scientific principle. So it would be like they want to blow up a bag and smash it, and that's thunder. Well, regretfully, that's not the way thunder works. That's not the process underneath. So I feel like with those kind of sound bites, you're not honoring the richness that's there. And as you say, it's propping it up because it's not a strong foundation. It's just something that's pretty superficial. And the most profound thing about scripture is that even when you read it and you understand the context of when it is being written, it has an ability to actually undermine the culture you're in. It's almost like it's deeper than those sound bites. And certainly God is greater than those sound bites. So to do that in many ways disrespects God and the journey of faith that we ought to be on. It's not simple. It's a journey that includes suffering and sometimes not understanding what's going on. And you have to be able to go on that journey and not just have a simple answer. One of the things that in some of the research I've done on natural hazards, I I looked at sermons from a variety of denominations, and I found the Catholic sermons to be the most profound because basically they were honest and said, we don't know why people suffer. We just know that God is with us. You know, don't give a pat answer. Just say it. And to me, that's much more honest.
Yeah, yeah. I know my daughter came with me to one of these apologetics conferences, and she was in high school at the time, and she's sitting off with her friends, and she's texting me the whole time, Mom, that's not accurate, but Mom, what about this?
That's right.
Mom.
That's right.
And at the end, she's like, well, that didn't help me to trust Christianity. I mean, now I'm like, I'm not sure that I should believe him about other stuff.
Right.
And I think how do you believe your pastor when they're talking about some kind of a spiritual thing that you can't test or touch when they're not willing to be accurate about things that are measurable and
that's right.
testable and well established.
Hmm. Well, and what you would want is the pastor to be talking to scientists and saying, okay, am I being accurate when I say this? It's like making sure that the language that you're using accurately represents what science understands in terms of how things work.
Yeah, but here you have
it's a kind of integrity.
Yeah, but here you have these apologetic leaders and even from my experience in church sometimes where they don't believe me. I mean, this could be an area where I am a subject matter expert and they don't want to hear. They don't want to know if it's accurate. They've decided the answer already.
Yeah, you're talking about a world that lives in certainty, you know, so.
And they
protect that with being suspicious of doubt or curiosity. Yep. That's not really something that's just a healthy skepticism, looking for intellectual honesty. In that world, that's a lack of faith. And so it becomes, you know, a no-no. Yeah. I want to get to a second in Christine's world of solutions and ask you a question where the rubber meets the road. And this is one that's a difficult question. It's been on our heart. It's the reason we started this show as an offshoot of our ministry to the nuns and duns and people who are on their way out of the church. I want you to talk to two different groups of people here, Doctor. We know, sadly, that there have been people who've started a journey in the STEM field, women who started their journey in the STEM field, who've been ostracized and humiliated and demeaned, and they've left. They said, this isn't worth it, and they've walked away. Sadly, this is also part of the phenomenon of the exodus of women and male allies who are leaving the church, leaving the faith even, because they see this patriarchal construct in evangelical Christianity, and even a backwards approach to gender and sexuality. They actually see much of the church as bigots. So I want you to take a second and talk. What would you say to a young woman who's approaching university level learning and she wants to go into the STEM field in regards to this topic? And what would you say to those young women who've left both fields because of the damage done by those testifying in the name of Christ and in the name of science?
You ask many questions in one, so I'm going to try to remember all of them. You know, I think for a woman going into the STEM field, you really have to seek out some mentors or peers to help you along the way, because often it involves talking with people that help you strategize when you run up against those barriers. And you need people who will say, no, you need to keep going. This is just one barrier. You're called to do this. You need to keep going. And in many ways, that's an easier and that's an easier answer and an easier group to deal with. And well, and but I would also say to that group, you can also don't feel like you can't have a family, you can't have children, but don't worry about everything now. Just go one step at a time and make decisions as they come. On the other side, it really is painful, really painful. It's hard for me to encourage women to certainly stay within churches where they feel like they have that their role as a scientist and being a woman is not respected or affirmed. And especially it's hard if you don't have people who are in that congregation who can encourage you. And of course, that's why the ASA exists, because often that's the case. So again, it's finding people who understand where you are, who can challenge you and affirm you, and it may not be within your congregation. And I think to broaden it, to think of all Christian traditions and finding one where you can thrive.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Finding your tribe, even if they're not local.
Right.
That's been very instrumental and helpful for me.
Yeah. That was the reason why I ended up going to Calvin, is to teach in a place where I had women who were academics, who had families, who loved scholarship, so that I could have people to talk to. And things they did to help me was, you know, you start to feel the social expectations, and they would help you minimize those. I remember one conversation where we were all having coffee together, and somebody said, you know, I feel like there's a competition for cookies at school. You know, your kids feel like you have to bring the best cookies to school. And somebody says, I don't remember signing up for that competition. It's like, okay, it's like thinking, helping people remove those things you've been carrying with you, all those expectations. Just find a peer group that will help you manage those expectations and will be a mirror that helps you get rid of those.
Yeah. Well, we are about an hour into our interview, and this has been such a great conversation. I certainly have been encouraged by it, and I hope that some of the solutions that we talked about can help make things better. But realistically, I think we still have a long ways to go too. Do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share to encourage our listeners, and maybe throw in there too, how does Jesus make a difference in your perspective on science and Christianity?
Well, I think that the uniqueness of the Christian faith is you have God in the person. And so in many ways, I try to live my life well, where I hold on to Jesus, all these other things, you know, you can't always sort out. Sometimes in science, you don't understand how faith impacts something, but you can still hold on to Jesus. And you can sit with that until it sorts itself out. And maybe that's true. Sometimes you need to remove yourself from a church, but you can hold on to Jesus until you're ready for the next stage and the next thing. So it's, I think, through life in general and all the uncertainties, you know, God does not promise an easy life, but he does promise just to be with you. And that, to me, is what it means to hold on to Jesus through it all. And give yourself grace.
Yeah. It does remind me of that British wag who said, if one wants to view true Christianity, one must nearly ignore all Christians. Jesus is the fullness of the Godhead bodily, yep. and he was a champion of marginalized groups. And that's mm-hmm. something that's undeniable. So whether it was suffer the children to come unto me, or sitting with the woman at the well, whether it was healing of the lepers, or making the heroes of his parables, the hated Samaritan and centurion, Jesus championed the marginalized. And even if you've been beaten over the head with the Bible, told you should keep your mouth closed and be the stewardess instead of the rocket scientist, cling to Jesus. I will second that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Coffee, tea, or milk?
Yeah. It's been a pleasure having you on, Doctor. Pleasure getting to know you. I must be honest with you. Christine is a big fan. She's been telling me wonderful, glowing things about you. I've watched an interview of yours online, and based on your recommendation, and I would encourage any of our viewers who haven't seen it, I went yesterday and I watched that Nova special on the picture of a scientist. And to be honest, I wrote to Christine, I was appalled. I had no idea that it was that bad. And to just think that it's even worse in the evangelical church in many ways, it pains my heart. So I'm grateful to have you on the show. I think it's wonderful that you're the new president of the ASA. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure's all ours.